Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and Mark Troutman's here with me today. How are you?
I am doing awesome. It's a great day to be in Colorado. It's actually a little colder than usual, so yeah. It's been super warm, and I'm kind of glad it's a little cooler, but kind of missing the heat, too.
Yeah. When I walked Georgie this morning, I had to bundle up, and I have like the electric hand warmers you can keep in your pocket and stuff. The wind was intense a couple days ago. Not quite as bad today, but yeah, it was nice for it to be chilly and just like a fresh dusting of snow. And the mountains looked a little
frosty.
Frosty. And it's just like white and it looks nice. So,
And the water, I mean, we could use the water too. So it's nice to see the ground get something because my grass is like looking very dead.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah.
So I haven't seen you in a while. You've been on trips, traveling. I mean, that's a fair bet. I haven't talked to you, but I know you've traveled a good chunk of the last few years. So what have you been up to maybe last month or something?
So this year, let's see, we went to the Caribbean for a couple of weeks and I rented a house. I did the whole St. Bart's die with zero, rent a house, bring some friends down. So we did that. And then I went to Camp Fi, New York, and we got snowed in. It was crazy.
Oh, man.
It was super fun. We had a great time and ended up being a 3-day event instead of a 2-day event because of the snowstorm. And we all got snowed in. And I actually think that was the better amount of time, given that we were kind of more, it wasn't as structured, I guess you would say. We had fewer discussions so that we'd had more free time. So the extra day, we actually were able to do some breakouts and stuff. So I felt good for the people that had not been to a Camp Fi, so they didn't feel like they got gypped. And so I think it worked out. So if they do something like that in the future, I'd suggest, why don't you just make it a 3-day instead of a 2-day if you want to have more time to do stuff around the city. So we had a really good time.
Cool. You're used to snow. Some other people from the South, like I'm originally from the South, and I could imagine it would be terrifying knowing that there's,
well,
I mean,
it was kind of cool because they closed the streets down from like 9 p.m. till noon the next day. So you're walking around in the city with no cars.
Yeah, yeah.
Totally. And it's super quiet and the snow's out. We went to Central Park and we were originally going to build a snowman, but then someone had already done that for us. So that was kind of cool. And then we went, and do you know the Friends episode where they're in the fountain? I don't know.
Yeah.
So we found the fountain and we did that and it was cool. It was fun. I enjoyed it. And Katie and I, Katie went with me as well. And we just kept walking and everyone else is like, man, it's cold. I'm going back. I'm like, what? It's crazy. Let's keep going. So Katie and I just hung out for a little while longer in the Central Park. So it's kind of cool.
Pretty neat.
We also went to tea at the plaza, which was fun.
Okay.
Katie really wanted to do that. That was kind of a bougie thing to do. And
So
that was kind of fun. And
wow. Pretty neat. Yeah.
Circle Line. Oh, this was a cool one. Check this out. So we went on the Circle Line, which is a boat that goes around Manhattan at night. So you get to see all the buildings, you know, lit up and Statue of Liberty and stuff like that. And Katie was the one that said, we should do this. So got on and got tickets. And it basically said, you want the basic ticket or do you want the premium ticket? And she asked me and I'm like, what's the difference? She's like, I don't know, $20. I'm like, premium ticket, you know? And then people were saying, what are you guys doing? We're like, oh, doing Circle Line. They're like, well, which ticket? And Katie was like, premium ticket. So what it was the front of the boat indoors with really roped off with super nice seats. And there's a balcony on the front, like a outdoor space only for that section. The Fi group was the entire section. So here we are, these supposedly frugal people getting the royal treatment on this Circle Line for an extra $20 a person. It was definitely well worth it. So if you do the Circle Line, definitely get the premium ticket.
Pretty fun. Yeah, it sounded like a heck of a trip and we were watching from afar with like the weather reports, which seemed maybe dramatic, but it sounds like it was a lot of snow.
Well, it was a good thing that a lot of people don't work. So no one was like, oh, I got to get back for work or whatever. I mean, a few people, but most people are just like, yeah, whatever, roll with it. No big deal. If you were at some other, you know, let's say work conference, people would have been freaking out. I got to get back. I got it, whatever. Yeah. And everyone was like, oh, no big deal. We'll just change our flights.
Yeah. You know? Stay a little extra. Yeah. And you guys know how to navigate like rebooking stuff or at least you know what you're getting into. So. Yeah. All right, cool. We got to get moving today. So this is listener questions, and we're going to cover preparing to retire from Maggie. We're going to talk about cars, leasing versus buying, and used cars, and that's Monica from California. And then kind of a generalized question about decumulating and getting into the mindset of maybe selling some of your assets to fund your cash flow and generally just spending after you have stopped working. And some of these lean into each other, like the first question and the last one kind of all go together. And if you want to have your question featured sometime in the future, number one, you can check out Buy Me a Coffee. I kind of get those questions first because they support the show. And the other way is you can, you know, shoot an email, sign up for the email list. My email is in the show notes and stuff like that. You can find it and you can send your question my way. And those are the best ways to get your questions in. So first one is preparing to retire. Fairly straightforward. So things that people who transition to CoSFI or retirement wish they would have done while they were still working, kind of their, in air quotes, their normal corporate job. There's a few areas here, some around mindset, some around actual like financial strategies and ways to get ready. So Mark, what should people be thinking about, let's say they're 2 to 3 years before they're going to stop working or transitioning to a CoSFI situation?
Yeah, you know, I never really did that. I'm trying to think back to how I, you know, went through that process. And I think I was designing my life. I guess I was kind of slowing down as I got to retirement. So in a way, I was building my life after FI already through the process. But if I was, let's say, a hard worker where I'm working 80 hours a week, and then I'm just going to turn the switch and just stop cold turkey, that's where I think most people might have the most challenge. And I think one way, I've heard some people do this, I haven't done it myself, but I've heard people say, I'm going to take like a 3 week vacation or longer than normal vacation and try out retirement. Like, do what I think I would do for retirement, not say, well, I'm going to go to the beach like a normal vacation. Like, I'm going to stay at home like a staycation and see how would I live my life if I was not going to work every day during the week. And I think a lot of it has to do with things like, if all your friends are going to work during the week, well, what are you going to do with yourself? And how do you fill that time? And I think you and I both probably recognize that it's pretty easy to fill your time. Mm-hmm. And now we kind of look back and say, how in the world did we have time to work? Mm-hmm. But initially, you do need to be a little bit proactive and think about how is that new time freedom that you're going to have be filled in a positive way, or I don't want to say productive way, but not a wasteful way, not just sitting in front of the TV and eating chips and, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. I don't know, watching reruns.
Or playing video games.
Yeah, so. I heard video games are very popular too.
So I got a lot of feedback from people that play video games, gamers, I believe you refer to as. So a few episodes ago, Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, said something about if you're over 18, you shouldn't play video games. And I was like, I didn't really know, I didn't get into games. I'm not a gamer. And I'm like, I've heard people get a little depressed after they play video games for a few months. And that's kind of what they're doing with their time once they retire. So I mentioned, be cautious. A lot of people chimed in the comments, especially on YouTube, and said, hey, it can be social, it can build community, it can exercise your mind. And if you're doing that, that's totally cool. We're not here to judge. But there is something around like consuming all the time. Like if you consumed social media or just watched, I don't know, TV shows all day, even really good ones or wonderful movies, if you only do that, you'll probably run into an issue. That said, if you're a gamer out there and you like it, keep doing it.
Yeah, I would say it's no different than being an avid consumer of social media. And I find myself telling myself, hey, there's that Facebook button. And I'm like, oh, don't touch that, yeah. You know, danger. Yeah. And because you can just get sucked into it. And I'm sure that's the same with video games or any other thing. I was thinking about my mom. She plays Bridge online, but it's a game and it ends. So that's good. And I don't know. I'm not a video game player, so I don't know if these are just endless games that just never end. But I would say set a timer for whatever it is that you're doing, social media, games, bridge, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I also find it's important. Now, I have a dog, you have a dog, and my dog takes me for a walk, which is great, gets me outside. And I think about my dog is 15, like what's gonna, what is it gonna be like when he's no longer around? I'm going to need to tell myself, you need to get outside. You need to get in the fresh air. And I've actually, I was reading an article about, I don't know what they call it, but in Europe, in some country, they're required to open their windows and have fresh air come in. It's actually like written in their lease or something. And I was like, you know what? Because my house, I don't need to open the windows necessarily to keep the house warm or cool or whatever. But I've been actively, you know, Becky Heptig, right? She was saying, she was over a while back, came to potluck, and she said, well, I'm going to go outside in the morning. I like to go outside and get some, you know, sun and fresh air. And I'm like, huh, that's interesting. I never really thought of that. So now I'm like opening the doors and the windows and walking outside just to get some light, some fresh air and natural light. And, you know, I think of the gamers, you know, the quintessential in the basement, in the dark, you know, maybe get outside a little bit more. That's whatever you're doing. So not specifically targeted at gamers, but just if you're, I don't know, playing music in the basement like yourself and you find yourself here for hours on end, maybe you got to take a break every once in a while.
So yeah, we're inclusive. So if you play games, that's cool. Just moderation, right? Moderation. Okay. So kind of like more back on track here with, you know, people that are about to retire. One of the things I've heard, again, like you, Mark, I kind of slowly transitioned from a corporate job to self-employment to kind of just doing like maybe 1% of the work that I used to do. And it's a hobby, which is this right here. So I didn't need to necessarily, but like if you want to keep in touch with any of your former coworkers, strong chance you're not going to see them again in the same capacity. And depending on your personality, a lot of friends are like friends of convenience where you're around them. So if you do want to try to keep in touch with your coworkers, obviously get their contact info, because like it's sometimes harder to get in touch depending on people taking like a social media diet, like they may be off.
I've heard that as well. I didn't really have a lot of social interaction, I guess you would say, at work. I didn't have a lot of coworkers to begin with, so that was part of it. But I would agree. You are definitely going to see those relationships kind of just fall by the wayside unless you actively keep them up. And I have a friend that does actively keep up with me, and I feel guilty sometimes that I don't reach out, and maybe I should do better at that. But yeah, if you want to keep those relationships, and that may be a question, maybe you don't want those relationships because they're not the type of people you really want to hang out with. But I would say, and this is one reason I moved to Longmont, was to kind of find the social group I wanted to be connected with. So maybe it's not the group that you are associated with at work, but it's another group. And it could be around a hobby. You know, a lot of people play pickleball or whatever, you know, or puzzling or whatever it is. And find that group and be proactive in trying to do things with that potentially new group that you really want to associate with rather than a group that you are currently associated with. So think kind of out of the box, like if I could rewrite everything, if I could start from scratch, what social interaction would I want to have as opposed to what do I have and what do I want to maybe protect, maybe look, seek out new avenues for that social connection.
Related to that is to explore your hobbies. So again, for us, we were gradually able to add more time with hobbies that existed. We added new hobbies, most likely. And I think if you're working like 80 hours a week or you have neglected your hobbies over the years, you may have to refresh your memory on like how much you enjoy those things and how you could like lose time. And I got a text this morning. I'll tell you who it is later. They put in their notice, I guess, either this morning or last night something.
Congratulations to you, whoever that is.
So he'll hear the episode whenever this comes out. You'll see him before. But anyway, I'm very excited for him. I think he was doing a lot of work. He does have a lot of hobbies. He should be able to like pick those up pretty quickly. But it's still total mindfuck, right? If you're like working for 20 years, putting in a lot of time, you're kind of at the height of your maybe effectiveness and maybe the span of control that you have and all the stuff you were working on depending on your job. And then it's like, oh yeah, you're just a regular dude. No one cares that you worked at that company at all. So
yeah, and that was one of the things that I found challenging was, so I was a portfolio manager and, you know, I was like, oh, I'm a portfolio manager. I manage a mutual fund. And for a couple of years, I was like, well, I used to be a portfolio manager and I used to manage a mutual fund. And I'm like, who am I? So I think that's a great point, is start thinking about the day after or the week after, month after you stop working, how are you going to introduce yourself? Or if someone asks, who are you and what do you do? Come up with a good answer that's something that is even potentially leading to a great conversation, as opposed to, well, I used to. So I hate the fact that that's what my answer was. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, oh, I'm part of the FOG community and we do some cool events. Oh, yeah, tell me about that, you know, mm-hmm. as opposed to, well, I used to do this and I used to be a corporate executive or whatever the answer would be, or a doctor, or a lawyer, or what have you. And I know it's hard to like disassociate yourself with that big part of your life. And that is one thing that I have found that people do have challenges with, for sure.
Mm-hmm. I think technically we're both portfolio managers for private equity, yeah, right?
Exactly.
So it's like, it's all semantics.
Yeah, and we, I'm a money manager. Yeah. It's just my money, but whatever.
Yeah. And you're like, ah, I mean, and you're like, ah, they're like, how much do you manage? And you like throw it out and they're like, I mean, I think that's a lot of money. I don't know. That's fine. We should try that. I guess if we need to impress people, but related to it. Okay. If you have that job and you're going to stop doing it, it is around identity and you have to kind of figure that out. Some people kind of freak out about it. And I mean, you just have to be comfortable with it. And it, I think it depends on who you're around and what you expect them to think. And I maybe have low expectations of myself, or, and I don't give a shit if people are impressed with what I do or not.
Well, I think it also has to do with how much you have invested in that self that you were at this point. Correct. After you retired. So yeah, someone, a doctor, for instance, goes to school for eons and spends a ton of money to become a doctor, and to unwind that is very difficult. So I find people that, especially like in the medical field, have a real challenge with, you know, kind of disassociating themselves with that identity. I think for people like us, maybe it's a little easier because it doesn't really matter, maybe. It's not as important to us. So I think that if you have a lot of background in what you were pre-retirement, right, yeah, you need to give a lot of thought to how am I going to move forward and how am I going to be this new person. And what's cool is, and like, I was just thinking back as you said that, in Camp Fire, New York, no one's like, well, I'm a whatever, you know, it's just like, oh yeah, I live in, you know, wherever. These are the things I enjoy doing.
Yeah. And it's something Carl and I would talk about. It's like, sometimes we still accidentally ask, oh, what do you do? Which it can give like insight into someone as you're meeting them for the first time. But when people ask us, we're kind of like, you know what? I'd rather talk about stuff that I am enjoying doing like right now, or projects I have coming up right now, versus like what I do, which is, could be a dead end conversation depending on who I am talking to. In quick note, I didn't mean to discount anyone who does have a strong identity with the thing that they did, because obviously totally valid. And everyone has their own psychological baggage around.
It's a part of your life and you don't want to necessarily ignore it. And there's nothing wrong with saying, well, I used to do this, but now I do this.
Yeah.
So don't necessarily walk away from who you were, but just realize that you're in a new chapter and you are potentially evolving into a newer version of yourself.
Let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts. So from a financial standpoint, what should people think about a couple years out before they're retiring or moving?
Well, I like to think of the standpoint from like, so you had this paycheck that you were receiving every 2 weeks or monthly or however you were getting paid. And how are you going to feel when that goes away? And how are you going to handle that? And what I've done for myself was I just recreated a paycheck. So instead of a company paying me, my portfolio is paying me. So think about, how are you going to design that and how is it going to be funded? And there's a couple of ways to do it. You could certainly just have a general portfolio, you know, whatever it is, 80-20, 70-30, whatever, and just pay yourself a paycheck out of it. But I like to do it in a little different way. It's kind of like the bucketing strategy in a way, I guess you would say. But I like to have a year or two or three, in my case, many years of paychecks stored up effectively in cash, short-term treasuries, even intermediate-term treasuries for the longer term. So I know that paycheck is going to come. And what I do is I actually have a separate bank account. It's a like a cash management account at Fidelity. That is my, let's call it, operating account. And then from my brokerage account or my investment accounts, I have a paycheck paid to that account every month. And I know it's going to be there. I know I'm always going to receive it. I'm not worried about where's my paycheck going to come from. I'm not worried about, oh, is this a bad time to sell stock and pay myself? I know some people fund themselves for a full year and just work that down. I like to have that kind of regular paycheck. And my friend Kevin Sylvester explained how he did it pre-retirement. He decided a couple of years, I think it was, before retirement, he said, I'm going to have my paycheck sent to my brokerage account instead and then pay myself the paycheck I want to start receiving after I stop working, which was a different number. So I think he was getting paid more than he was going to live on, or vice versa. I don't know exactly the details, but it wasn't the same amount. So it wasn't like, well, money's just going in one account and coming right back out the same way. No, it was like, what is my retirement paycheck going to look like? And I'm going to start before I retire and kind of gear myself up for this is the way I'm going to live my life in retirement. I thought that was great. That was a great suggestion.
So you mentioned 3 years, and I think it's probably because the average recession is about 3 years. They can last longer, of course, but like from a percentage standpoint, 3 years gets you through most situations. Is that the idea?
Yeah, and there's no exact school of thought on, is it 1 year? I've heard 1 year, I've heard 2 years. In my case, it's more like 10 years, which is crazy, but I just like it. And it's kind of like somebody explained to me at one point, they're like, when you've won the game, why keep playing in essence? And I'm like, well, I'm still, because I do draw, if you look at it from a drawdown standpoint, it's not a high percentage. So even though it's 10 years, I'm still got a lot of equities, probably in the neighborhood of 70, 30, 75, 25 still, even with a 10-year kind of cash / treasury runway. And it just makes me sleep better at night. I'm comfortable with it. I don't need to have the maximum growth possible going forward.
Yep. Yep. And I was going to say, I have a Morgan Housel book right here on the shelf, which is Psychology of Money.
Yeah.
And I think he he has like more cash than what people would recommend and much more conservative. It, kind of what you're saying, where it's just like, you don't need the returns, and now you have a very strong buffer that could get you through. Like, you're probably not even thinking of it that way. You're just like, I don't need it to keep growing, so it's very safe right. to keep.
And
it
the
like
other
this.
Thing I would say that I did do, and I have found beneficial, is I've turned off reinvestment of capital gains and dividends. So that cash flow is always coming into the portfolio to help replenish the cash that's going out. And in my case, effectively, it's almost the same amount that's going out. So in a way, I don't even need that 10 years, but I just feel more comfortable. I don't ever want to be in a situation where somebody says, do you want to go on this trip? And I say, no, the market's kind of down. I don't really feel comfortable. I want to say yes, hell yes. Mm-hmm. We're doing it. The money's there. It's already earmarked. Let's go.
Let's move on to question number two. This is around cars, like the true cost of car ownership and how things have shifted a little bit. We do have this question in, which is kind of generalized. So Monica is wondering about leasing versus buying, especially with the, in quotes, like new generation of cars. She'd really enjoy the true cost of car ownership from Choose FI back in 2017. But she mentioned that cars nowadays maybe don't have the same longevity. There's been a lot of technological changes. There's more computers and stuff in cars now than there were. And like the car that we have, it's a Honda CR-V 2011, and it's a good car. I think that's like a very good generation. The thing is, Monica has an 11-year-old paid-off vehicle in California. It has very strong smog related rules in California, right? So she will need to have some work done and it's probably not worth fixing it. So they're debating leasing versus buying. They're concerned about the decline of quality and longevity in newer cars, like in the last 5 to 10 years, especially the ones that have great reputations like Hondas and Toyotas. And you're a Toyota man, right?
Yes. Yes, okay. I am.
And it's a thing that we could look at here. So new versus used versus lease, and maybe a lease is a decent idea. Now, quick note, one of my neighbors, he got a killer deal on a lease. I think it was a Hyundai, is it called an Ioniq? And I want to say like for a 2-year lease, all in, it was like $7,000 or something like that, because I think it was either was an older model and they needed to get these out of the lot. So he's going to be able to drive a car for a very cheap price. And then potentially, he was telling me the other day, I think it's a few more months before the lease is up. I think he's just going to return it and get another lease.
Yeah. And usually, I mean, if you think about the math in leasing, so effectively you're renting the car for a period of time. And the other thing, the challenge with leasing is that you are effectively agreeing to use the car for a handful of months. There is usually some kind of down payment too. So it's not like just the monthly payment. So you do have to be careful about it. It might say $199 or $299 a month, but you had to put $5,000 up to begin with, right? So you have to really math it out. And it might be something like 12,000 miles a year. Now, if you're going to drive exactly 12,000 miles, you will get kind of the appropriate value for what you paid, potentially, again, considering the math, and we can go a little bit into that. But what if you only drive 5,000 miles? You've paid for 12, and you've only used 5, so you've, in essence, overpaid for that lease. And the converse is, what if you drove 20,000 miles a year? You're going to be hit with a very high mileage charge when you turn it back in if you don't buy it out at the end of the lease. So I think in most cases, it pays to run the numbers in both scenarios, purchase or lease, because sometimes I have seen, like maybe in the case with your neighbor, they're trying to blow out a vehicle, they're willing to give it away for a low monthly cost. Usually what's going to happen in that case is that the buyout on the back end is just going to be way over the value of the car and you're not going to want to buy it out.
Yep.
Now, I have never leased myself directly, but I was involved in a lease in a way, in that I had a car that was paid for by the company I worked for, and it was like a 36-month lease, and they were paying a lot of money per month for the car, and I actually got to choose the car, so I chose a Toyota 4Runner, and they were paying a ridiculous amount per month for this vehicle, and when I left the job, there was, I think, 2 or 3 months left in the lease, and they said, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, what? Give me the contract. And the contract showed that the buyout was going to be substantially less than the value of the vehicle. And I only had a couple of months, so I knew a pretty good idea of what it was. And I'm like, well, I will take over that lease because I only have to pay 2 more crazy payments or 3 more crazy payments. But then I can buy it out at a super low cost relative to the value. Even if I bought it and just resold it, I would have been ahead. So effectively,
cool.
In a lease, either you're paying a lot up front or you're potentially going to pay a lot on the back. So what you're hoping is, if you're going to lease a car and turn it back in, is that the leasing company has assigned too high of a value for that vehicle at the back end, at the return price. So they're saying, let's say it's a $40,000 vehicle and they're going to lease it to you for, I don't know, let's say hypothetically 3 years. And they're saying after 3 years, it's still going to be worth $35,000. Then they're working the numbers in that 3-year period at a very low amount. Yeah, you would say, I might want to take that deal and lease it and just hand it back because it's not going to be worth $35,000. And I've heard that people have done this in the EV market because two reasons. One is the leasing companies were assigning potentially too high of a value for the car when it was going to come back. And it's a judgment call. You know, are you right or are they right? You just don't know until the end, right? And then the other thing people are saying is there's so much technology in these cars. I'm not sure I want to own this vehicle long term because of kind of the things that she's suggesting here. Maybe they're going to have a lot more issues. Now, I'm surprised to hear about issues with Toyotas and Hondas. I have not heard that. That's news to me. And I've had, now mine are older. I have a 2008 Toyota FJ, which has 220,000 miles, and I've barely spent a dime on it other than normal maintenance. Mm-hmm. So I've gotten my money's worth out of that for sure. I did just get a relatively new, so it was 2 years ago, Toyota RAV4. I only have 5,000 miles on it. So had I leased that, it would have been crazy because I only put, 2,500 miles a year on it.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't make sense because no one's going to write a lease with only a 3,000 mile mileage cap. So anyway, I do think you can run the numbers both ways and see, does it make sense or not?
In your new car, it's great. I think I rode in it right after you picked it up or something like that.
It still has a new car smell.
Yeah. I think the Toyotas and Hondas that Monica is citing, I think it's they don't last potentially quite as long, or maybe there's a few issues. So instead of lasting 25 years and still has a lot of original parts and all that, there's a few more issues. So in the long run, I think, I didn't run the numbers, but I'm pretty sure Monica will probably do better to get the, a used car, few years old, just like the playbook that we have that Brad and Jonathan presented in, I think, episode 22, 2017. Of Choose FI, probably pretty much the same. You may have maybe a little less longevity on those used cars, but the percentages probably still work out where those are some of the best brands of cars you can get with, if you take care of them, if you do your maintenance properly, they're going to work out pretty well. I can't comment on the EV side or even hybrid. I haven't had any of those, but the technology has been around for, the Prius has been around for a super long time, right?
Yeah. And I would say that leasing often makes sense for business owners because they want to be able to deduct it. And also frequently leasing can work in the higher end market, especially for people that want the new shiny thing every couple of years. You don't want to be buying G-Wagon and trying to run it for 20 years because that buyer typically is going to want a newer one sooner. So I think you'll usually find leasing in the higher end of the market. Purchasing probably makes more sense, especially because I think a lot of times when people look at a lease, they can be convinced to get a nicer car than they ordinarily would because it's you could lease this fancy car for a certain amount of money versus having just the Toyota Corolla, which will work fine in a great car, but maybe they want to be in some fancier car. So I think some people kind of justify leasing to allow themselves to get into a nicer vehicle.
What's the fanciest car you ever had?
Well, I used to have a lot of Porsche 911s, so those would be the fancy. Oh, I did have a BMW M5 one time.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah. So I used to buy used cars and drive them for a year or two and sell them for almost what I paid for them.
Right. And that's a great trick.
Yeah. So I had an Audi S4, I had a BMW M5, a bunch of 911s, which I just kept and drove those on the racetrack and stuff like that. But I had Mini Coopers, super fun car.
All right.
Yeah, like little go-karts when they first came out. We had two of them. We had a pair. That's fun. Because if we saw The Italian Job, have you ever seen that movie? Where they have the Mini Coopers and they load them up with the stolen money and they're driving around Italy. It's a great car movie if you ever want to end the drive. And we're like, we got to get those.
That's pretty fun. Do you miss having or you don't have a little sports car right now?
No, I don't. I keep thinking about it. Becky and Steven Heptig are, they're always trying to push me into getting something. I'm like, I don't know. I always worry about stuff, I worry about it getting scratched or dented. And then it's just I should just get over it. And then I'm like, but am I really going to use it that often? And I don't know.
So do you ever rent them?
No, and I've thought about that.
Yeah, because then it's you have to do all the maintenance and insurance and all the other stuff. It's
I should do that.
Follow up with me. We'll hear about your little,
fancy car rental.
another tangent, but we got to get back on track here. Okay, so the last one here is around decumulation and spending and selling. And a little teaser for the next episode are coming up pretty soon. when you look at the 4% rule, like it helps you not run out of money. And I don't think you spend enough, which will, again, that's another episode. So we won't get into it too much. I will say that many questions like this come up around like being a little scared to turn the switch. And part of it is our behavior and our habits of accumulating and getting a little bit of a rush from seeing our balances go up and up for decades. And we're like, this is great. At some point, you have to start spending. It'll stay even. Maybe you'll have down years. It'll go down. That's part of the plan. And it's what we have been planning the whole time. But it's still a little scary to start selling. I needed to start selling, I guess, starting last year. Previously, I was earning more money, but I turned that down. And for the cash flow to work out, I needed to sell a little bit, just a little bit, a couple thousand per month or a little more, depending on what's going on. And it's a good exercise. It's not a huge amount, but like I have the mechanisms in place and I would mark the date each month. I would sell opposite of dollar cost averaging, like sell it and then move it into my checking account and then pay our credit card from that. And similarly to what you were talking about, but less automated. And I got used to it and it's fine. And I'll keep doing that for many years. I did turn off the reinvestment as well. I mean, that's a fine thing to do. So you preserve the number of shares that you have and you just get some dividends out of the equation there. So it's not too hard, but you just have to get used to it. And it's a mindset shift. How did you deal with it, Mark?
Yeah, I didn't deal with it initially. I ignored it because when I retired, I had kind of looked around and I was like, ooh, I have this classic car that I don't really need anymore, talking about cars, and I could sell that and then I don't have to draw down from my portfolio. So yeah, I did that in the first year. And then to avoid it in the second year, I got lucky in that I owned a very tiny piece of a company I worked for, and it was a private company, so I couldn't like cash out. They had to cash me out whenever they decided to. And fortunately, that was in year two. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough to kind of not have to draw down really anything in the year two. And then by year three, I actually had to start taking money out of the portfolio, and it hurt. It was like, whoa, just like I said, you like to watch it go up and up and up. And now you got to get into this mode of, yeah, it's actually potentially going to go down. Now, what's interesting is I've been retired, 10 years now, and it's still going up, even though I'm drawing down. But there will be a day.
Yeah, it was a good 10 years.
Yeah, there will be a day when it goes down. And it was interesting. We were doing a little exercise on FinTalks the other day, and somebody was walking through a projection lab, and it shows, you know, a graph of, you know, your assets and how it's predicting what your portfolio will look like. And right there on the screen, it's showing it go a peak and declining. And I think that's a good exercise to at least see that, hey, that's the point of this, is it's not meant to grow and grow and grow so you can just give it to somebody else. Trust me, you give it to somebody else after you pass away, they're going to spend it. They're going to have no problem watching that number go down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You need to get into that same mindset. It's a challenge. My friend Kevin, he graphs this out himself, and he actually says it needs to go down. We need to make it start going down. So whether it's through more spending or gifting or whatever, you need to start getting comfortable with that was the point of the exercise, and we do need to start allowing it to decumulate. And I do think it's a major mind shift, and it's very difficult. I still like to watch the numbers go up. You know? I admit.
How do you determine where the peak should be? And there's a lot of ways to look at it. There's probably no answer, right? So when I first think about this problem, and what we're describing is like you're looking at your net worth and your projection out. And at some point, you have a peak net worth, and then it goes down to some number, hopefully not all the way to zero, but hopefully maybe a few $100,000. Now, obviously, we don't know when we're going to die, so that's really hard to figure out. You have to have some timeline and then figure out where to put that peak. How do you approach that?
Theoretically, problem? It's going to be as soon as you retire. That's, I mean, mathematically, that's where it probably would be. Again, depending on what you're withdrawing and so forth and what the returns are, sequence of returns and all that kind of stuff. And I think that the reason for most of us that have retired in the last decade that it has continued to go up is because we've had a good sequence of returns. Now, that could be completely different from somebody else who retires into a bad sequence. So I think mentally, you need to be ready for that decline to start immediately, because that is what it could be if you had not just the worst sequence, but just not a great sequence. Mm-hmm. So I think mentally, you need to be prepared for that to start declining from day one. But most people will find that that may not be the case for them, because if you're withdrawing a reasonable amount, it's likely that your portfolio may grow by more than what you're spending. Mm-hmm. But you do need to be careful about it continuing to grow for an extended period of time, because then you're just going to run into,
yeah,
Kevin says, the hogs, the heirs, the organizations, and the government. What are they going to do with it? They're going to spend it. No problem.
They will. Yeah. And I was going to say, our projection just, it grows out of control. So we need to spend a little bit more. One thing that could be an interesting exercise for you. So you mentioned you've been retired about 10 years. So we'll say 2015.
Yep. 2015 was when I left. Yeah.
So 2015, last 10 years. Great. If you would have retired 10 years earlier, 2005, in the first few years, you would have had like a little growth at the beginning and then cut in half or something like that.
Yeah.
Through the Great Recession. And then it would have slowly grown back up and been in decent shape by 2013 or something like that, maybe back where it was.
That's why I like that cash buffer.
10 years.
Yeah, because I have, the market has just been going up and up and up. And actually with this latest kind of Iran war, if you want to call it a war or whatever you want to call it, I'm actually shocked that the market is acting as well as it is. I'm an older dude and I've been through a lot of these, and typically, the market takes a big dive, and it has not. So what I have done, and actually just did a podcast I'm going to release and talking about this, is I said to myself, what if your equities were down 50% tomorrow? How would you feel? And what would it look like on paper? And that's why I come back to this kind of 10-year cash buffer, like, all right, doesn't matter. Because hopefully within 10 years, when I really actually need to dip into that equity portfolio, things will be back to, quote, normal, I guess you would say. But I do think there are many people out there that just don't think about the downside risk, because we just haven't had much of it in a long period of time. And the ones that we have had have been so short and so fast to recover that I think I was looking on, I don't know, some forum somewhere, and someone was like, are you buying the dip? And I'm like, what dip? I mean, the market is like down 1% year to date. There is no dip,
you know? It's not much. Well, and the thing is, like, the Great Recession wasn't that long ago. I mean, I remember. Mm-hmm. So, although I didn't have much money then.
Yeah, it was like a, what they call Chinese water torture, where every day it's like down and down and down and down and down. Yeah.
And it just stayed low. All right. Cool. Anything else around getting into the mindset of like just being able to spend and like, maybe, you know,
talk to people that have been through this. And that's kind of where myself and a couple of others who have been down this road for a period of time, we try to help people understand like our mindset, the things that we had challenges with. So maybe find someone who has already been through this. And again, we had the wind at our back, so it's a little more difficult to kind of say, yeah, this is how we walk through this terrible period. But yeah, I would say find somebody who is ahead of you in the whatever retirement period and learn from them.
Yep. And I'll mention maybe the converse of that. We also get a lot of advice. Actually, we'll just say someone like me, right? So I have the tailwind as well, where it's been great many years. I do remember like .com bubble and then the Great Recession and everything. But at the same time, it's easy for us to take advice from people that haven't seen the couple extra decades of ups and downs and all that stuff that you have seen, Mark. So be careful who you take your advice from, because some people are like 100% equities, don't worry about anything else, but they're not really limiting the downside risk. Maybe it's fine. They have to deal with more volatility is the thing. And can they handle a 50% decline? And what are they going to do? Are they going to freak out? Do they have to get a part-time job?
Yeah. That's what's so interesting is that you ask people, how would you feel if your portfolio was down 20%, 30%, 40%? And most people are like, oh, I could handle it. You know, but until it actually happens, you don't really know how you're going to react. Mm-hmm. And so usually advisors will say, especially for someone who went through those periods, how did you actually react during that time frame, mm-hmm. as opposed to what do you think you will do? So honestly, I think experience in those situations is really going to tell you what, you know, how you're going to react. You won't know until you go through it. And people are going to think they're going to react one way and they don't. I see it all the time. Be aware that it can happen and tell yourself it's a possibility. Mm-hmm. It's likely to happen at some point. So, and I'm not predicting the market going down or anything like that, but I'm always thinking a little bit ahead and out of the box and like, what if, and maybe what if never happens. So fine. Great.
What I was going to say, we could predict and just not put a time frame on it. We're like, it will go down by 50% sometime.
So hold the episode until it happens and then publish it. We're like, see?
We said it. Yeah. In the next 10 years, almost certainly. All right, cool. Mark, this has been great. We're going to do another episode about basically is the 4% rule bad advice now? And that'll be coming out soon. For people that want to learn more about you and check out your show, where should they go?
Yeah, marksmoneymind.com is the URL, or just on any of the major podcasts, look for Mark's Money Mind. And I typically publish whenever I feel like talking about something. It's just a hobby for me. This is not a job. It's not for money or anything. It costs me money to do it, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I just enjoy, it helps me think. So like my last episode that will be coming out shortly, it was just what's on my mind, how am I thinking about things? I'm talking about like taxes and travel and market volatility, as a matter of fact. So it's usually just what I'm thinking about. And I'm usually thinking of the audience as, you know, if we were just having a conversation over a cup of coffee, what are we talking about? So that's the gist of it.
And by the time this episode comes out, the episode you cited will be published already, so we can make sure we link to that and people could check it out. There's links in the description, and you have a bunch of episodes out so people could kind of look through, see what they're interested in. And I would say it's a great podcast to recommend to maybe sometimes there's newer people to FI. You have a series where you kind of walk people through some of the beginning steps. So it could be good for like even a person in their early 20s.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I teach a financial literacy class in the high school, and I was asked to kind of put together some videos for the students that didn't make the class. So I said, well, I'll just turn it into a podcast series. So I did that in December. It's a 6-part series that really walks someone through the basics. Mm-hmm. And it was for newer people. You don't have to be in your 20s or, you know, in high school.
Sure.
Just someone that's newer to these concepts. Yeah.
Perfect. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High FI podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do 3 things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Yeah, so you just saw the pamphlet over there for Casa Bonita.
A kid's passport pamphlet, most importantly.
They handed it to me and they were like, it's fine for you. I guess they looked at me and they were like, you're simple enough where this is going to be a great pamphlet. There's a little map in there and it's, yeah, feel free to open it up. So you recognize the name. And Casa Bonita started in like 1973. So it's a Mexican restaurant, like a themed place. And there's cliff divers, and it's, I mean, again, it's for kids. There's like a little arcade, there's a puppet show, there's Black Bart's Cave, and some other stuff. It's in Denver. They had a couple others, but I learned about it from South Park.
Oh.
In like 2004 or five. And I was a big fan of South Park, influential for my whole life.
And very educational.
Yeah. I learned everything that I know from South Park. And they did an episode because Cartman wanted to go to Casa Bonita for his birthday. And yeah, a lot of crazy stuff happens in the show. And I thought it was completely made up. So like 20 years later, I find out, oh, it's actually a real restaurant. And Trey and Matt used to go there when they were younger, when they were kids, okay, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it, over the years, it declined in quality. It closed in 2020. Matt and Trey, which are like, they're like billionaires now, right? So those are the creators of South Park. They bought the place, which is like in a strip mall. Like there's a laundry place next door and like whatever normal stuff. And it looks beautiful. It's crazy. So they bought it. They renovated it. They spent like 10x whatever they expected, on the scale of like 40 or 50 million or something like that. But they redid everything and it's awesome. And there's cliff divers and it's beautiful.
Like real cliff divers.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It's really cool. Huh. And if you have kids,
how's the food? It. Is the food any good?
It's good enough. It's okay. Fine. I think it was really horrible around the time that it closed, but it was adequate. And yeah, if you have kids, they'll enjoy it. If you're passing through town, it'll be fun.
Or if you are a kid at heart.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Or if or if you have a simple approach to life like me and low expectations, it'll be fine. I was like, this guac's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you have visitors in town or you need like some other activity, I would suggest checking it out. And
you said it's in Denver?
Yeah, I can't remember if it's east or west. So it's, I think it's a little west of like downtown by a few miles. Honestly, it's kind of a sketchy-ish part of town. I think it's better now than it was, but I think it was like not that great a few years ago. It was like a pretty rough spot. But yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, one of my experiences with Denver is losing my catalytic converter. So hopefully you don't lose your catalytic converter when you go to the Casa Bonita. But other than that, it sounds very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's all right. I haven't heard any of those tales, but I have heard like at the Denver airport, it's like some of the far away parking spots. Like
yeah, apparently the more public ones.
Yeah.
Like, what is it? I don't even know. It's I don't want to name it. Yeah, Pikes Peak parking lot, I heard, is an issue. And I go to Park DIA or Fine. That's where I used to go.
Okay.
And because you have to, I mean, I guess anyone could somehow get in there, but it just seems like, why would you pick on that spot?
Yeah.
Doesn't seem logical. Pick an easier target, right?
Yeah, it's weird.
And that's why I know Carl and Mindy say they park like at the airport. But I have not had good experience. Now, not in Denver, but in Newark, New Jersey, I had my car stolen from the airport. And the cop basically just said, well, they saw that you got out of your car, you're going into the airport, you're probably not going to be around for a while, so you're probably not going to report this for a while, so easy target. Yeah. So, man,
how long ago was that?
Oh, boy. That was a long time ago. I would say 20 years ago.
Gotcha. Yeah, and I'm just like, I wonder if it's a little better now these days with like so many, there's like cameras everywhere, right? So
yeah, well, apparently, so this was in a parking lot that had a gate and everything, and they just drove right through the gate, and I'm like, and that didn't like trigger anything? And they're like, no, you know. I'm like, what?
People go through the gate all the time. It's not really a big gate. Deal.
Okay, I guess that's normal in Newark, New Jersey. Oh, well. So yeah, I also don't bring my new car. I bring my older car.
Yeah,
I don't know. Also, for hail purposes, if I'm parking outside.
Right. We haven't done this yet, but, or at least in a while, but to park in the parking garage, like close by, where I think maybe Pete was telling me he's testing that out, where I guess it's what Carl and Mindy are doing. Like, hey, is it pretty fun to just like park and then walk over there instead of waiting for the shuttle and all the other stuff? Mm-hmm. But yeah, with the hail, and depending on the time of year, you could come back and there's like a considerable amount of snow or ice on your car.
Not this year.
Yeah, not this year.
Oh man. Yeah. That's a whole nother story.